on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hello there. Welcome to Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia, Radio Australia and across the world via the web. This evening, as the next part of our special summer series on Sunday nights on ABC Radio, we're going to spend a little time with the Americans. Yes, this week sees the, tonight in fact, in America, sees the beginning of the celebrations to mark the inauguration of Barack Obama as President of the United States. And through the week, a number of events will be happening. ABC television will be picking it up live from Wednesday morning at 3 a.m. and then following through. But even today in the USA, the week begins with a special event at the Lincoln Memorial. And at that event, a man named Gene Robinson, Bishop Gene Robinson, will give the invocation. I'll tell you more about that a little later on. Following our first hour this evening, Rachel Conn will be along to take us to a monastery garden and the spirit of a number of those traditions which take us back to Donegal in Ireland and the art of the labyrinth. Rachel Conn will join us in a monastery garden in about an hour's time. Following that, the Inquisition, Jeff Wood, to take us on a musical pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, the great Spanish place of pilgrimage. And after Jeff, an encounter. Margaret Coffey has produced an encounter documentary from a Mission Hill station in Papua New Guinea. And if you are sticking around for the evening, a really fascinating insight into the work of a hospital hill station in Papua New Guinea, still a place of great need and increasingly so with HIV and the extent to which it's penetrated even up into those highland communities. But for now, to get us started on our trip to the USA for the great week of celebrations, here's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir whilst they're in Australia, and a great song of inspiration, Climb Every Mountain. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir at the Sydney Opera House, recorded a few years ago, but a suitable way to introduce the week of celebrations marking the inauguration of Barack Obama as President of the United States, the first black man to achieve that office. And marking the week are a number of events that involve religious ceremonial. The inauguration of President Obama on Wednesday morning, our time, Tuesday, United States time, will be the invocation prayer will be given by Rick Warren. Now, you may have seen the rather unique event when opposing candidates in the presidential election appeared together, when John McCain and Barack Obama appeared together in a church, not in Washington's National Cathedral, but at Saddleback. And Rick Warren is the pastor of Saddleback, one of America's premier mega churches, situated in Orange County in Los Angeles. Rick Warren hosted that gathering, and perhaps by way of a little thank you, Barack Obama has invited Rick Warren to deliver the invocation at his inauguration on Tuesday US time, Wednesday morning our time. Rick Warren is a pro-life conservative. That created outrage among the liberals who had so vociferously supported Barack Obama in his campaign. Well, just to even up the ledger, it's recently been announced that this morning or tomorrow morning our time, Sunday morning, USA time, the week's celebrations will kick off at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., with an event at which the invocation prayer will be given by Gene Robinson. Anglican Bishop Gene Robinson created a worldwide stir and possibly split the Anglican Church worldwide as he's gay and the first gay bishop appointed by the Anglican Church. So Barack Obama has evened up the ledger. Sunday morning, Gene Robinson, openly gay Anglican bishop, and Wednesday at the inauguration, Rick Warren, pastor of Saddleback Community. Well, Saddleback was founded in 1980, and Rick Warren, its founder, is also the author of perhaps the biggest-selling round of self-help books in the world today, the Purpose-Driven Life series. And Rick Warren joined us just a few weeks ago to talk about his books, his church, and his politics. Rick Warren, welcome to Sunday Night.
Hello, John, and I love everybody in Australia. I've been there many times, and I can't wait to come back.
Well, it's good to have you with us. When you drove into down through Orange County in Los Angeles back in 1980, how well-formed were the ideas that have led to Saddleback and the Purpose-Driven Life?
Most of them, I would say, there's a great line in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark where somebody asks Harrison Ford, what are we going to do next? And he says, how do I know I'm making it up as we go along? And that would have to be the honest truth about Saddleback Church. I began the church with one person, my wife, Kay. We were 25 years old. I preached the first sermon. She didn't like it. It's been downhill ever since.
I'm also told you very quickly made an astute judgment that your first congregant should be the real estate agent.
Yes, absolutely. The first guy who was driving us around, helping us find our little apartment to rent and move into, I asked him, I said, Don, do you like to go to church anywhere? He says, no, I hate church. I said, great, you're my first member. And so we started with Don's family and my family, and of course today there are over 100,000 names on our church roll. This coming up Christmas, we'll have well over 40,000 people in our 13 services that we will do over several days. Saddleback is a 120-acre campus now. It's about the size of a college. So, I pastor a church the size of a city.
This is something that
mayor.
This is something that Australians have yet to fully grasp. We've got a number of mega churches, as you know, but the size of the campus that you describe is as yet quite unique, certainly in Australia. We wouldn't be familiar with it. But let me ask you something else related to that. What led you to think through the way people go to church in the 1980s? That brought you to the position where you thought, now, hang on, there's something wrong with the way people go to church. You took church out of the sanctuary and into the suburbs.
Well, John, what actually I did is as I went out, and the first thing I did is I went door to door for about 12 weeks just interviewing people. And I would knock on a door in our neighborhood, and I would say, hi, my name's Rick, and I'm taking an opinion poll. There's no right or wrong answers. I'm not here to sell you anything. I'm not here to convince you of anything. I'm not here to convert you. I'm not even here to invite you to anything. I just want to know your opinion. And I asked a series of questions like, if you were looking for a church, what kind of things would you look for? And why do you think most people don't attend church? And what advice would you give to me as a pastor of a new church who really wants to be a benefit to the community? How could I help you? And what I discovered, John, is that most people were not anti-God. They just didn't like church. And they said, oh, I think God, Jesus, that's just fine. I just don't like church. And I thought, if I ever found a church that really ministered to my needs, then I'd probably go. And so I thought, I've got to find out how to say something on Sunday that is relevant for Monday morning. And so we went back and retooled everything, the way that I shared the Bible messages, the kind of songs that we sang, the way we would welcome people. We made it a relaxed, casual environment. And it was a place where people said, I feel comfortable bringing my friends. The vast majority of members of Saddleback Church were not church members of any other church before coming. They had no religious background at all, or maybe as a kid they went to a Sunday school or catechism but hadn't been in 20 or 30 years.
There was a similar movement going on, I guess it sprang out of the 70s and 80s, across cultures, and you had another example of it in Chicago with Bill Hybels and Willow Creek. Mm-hmm. What's the similarity in the models there?
Well, the similarity is we both care about starting where people are, not where we want them to be. The difference would be that we, at Saddleback Church, we came up with what we call a life development process, and It's a systematic plan to help people move to maturity, emotional maturity, spiritual maturity, spiritual maturity, in which we move people through graduated stages of growth. We let people make their own steps of growth, but it allows them to say, here's where I am spiritually. And most people don't know where they are spiritually, and that's why we have to help people what we call know God, grow in God, serve God, share God, and honor God. And we want to help people in these five areas. And we've been doing training. I've been to Australia many times, have trained pastors in Perth, in Cairns, in Brisbane, in, of course, Sydney, and in Melbourne.
When you take that approach, you're essentially saying to people, look, God is relevant in your situation where you are. And this model led you not only to talk about where people are in church, but where they are in life. So your writings led you from the purpose-driven church to the purpose-driven life.
That's exactly right, John. And what I discovered is that God is extremely relevant in our life. What is irrelevant is a lot of the ways we talk about God. And so if I get up on a Sunday and I speak about God in a boring way, the problem with that is people think God's boring. And God is not boring at all. I mean, you can't have the creator of the universe come into your life without it radically changing you, bringing meaning, purpose, significance. And what I say is that everybody tends to be living at one of three levels. There's the survival level, there's the success level, and there is the significance level. Most of the world, John, lives at the survival level. They don't know, am I going to have my next meal? Will I have a roof over my head? Am I going to have clean water? And, of course, in Australia, even the poorest of the poor in Australia are rich compared to the rest of the world. Because most of the world's poor would love to have the problems of people who live in Australia or the United States or the United Kingdom or anywhere else. Because they're worried about, even just survival. Now, we do have a lot of people today who are living at what I call emotional survival, and that is they're just putting in their time and barely getting through to the weekend, dreaming of going to Tahiti and trying to escape. And that is a survival level, but most people today live at what I call the success level. And success means you have just enough money to not only pay your bills, but if you want to go to a restaurant, you can. If you want to go to a movie, you can. Money means choices. But as Americans and as Australians and as people in Western culture have moved up in their mobility and prosperity, what I've heard a lot of people saying is, if I'm so successful, why do I still feel unfulfilled? Why do I still feel like a fake? Why do I feel like something's missing? And the answer to that, John, is because we were made, God made us for more than just survival and more than success. We were made for significance. And significance comes when we discover who we are, God's purpose for our lives, and begin to fill that purpose. We were made for a purpose, not just to exist.
Rick Warren, what do you think generally of what's called the prosperity gospel?
You know, I think first place, I'm opposed to putting an adjective in front of the gospel in any way. There is no prosperity gospel. There is no success gospel. There is no white gospel, black gospel. There's just the gospel. And the truth is, Jesus was very, very clear about this. He said, a man's life consists not in the abundance of things that he possesses. In other words, the greatest things in life are not things. That we're to live for not just the here and now, but in light of eternity. The Bible tells us that life is a test, it's a trust, it's a temporary assignment, and God is seeing what we do with what we're given. And one day we're going to stand before God, and he's going to ask us two questions. First, what did you do with my son, Jesus Christ? He's not going to say, what religion were you? What school did you go to? Denomination? What church did you go to? He's going to say, what did you do with my son, Jesus Christ? Did you get to know him? I sent him to earth at Christmas time. Did you ever get to know him? And the second thing he's going to say is, what did you do with what you were given? And I think a lot of people are going to be embarrassed when they get to heaven, and God's going to say, wait a minute, you think I gave you all those things just to pile up riches for yourself? You know, we have here in America a bumper sticker on the back of cars that says, he who dies with the most toys wins. And I say, he who dies with the most toys still dies. Life is not about things. It's about serving God by serving others. The only way you can serve God is by serving other people, and your value has no basis on your valuables, and your net worth and your self-worth are not the same thing. It's not about prosperity. It's about God's purpose for your life.
You're on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Rick Warren, founding pastor of the Saddleback Church in the United States, where recently Barack Obama and John McCain discussed their lives and their vision of the future for the United States in the lead up to the recent presidential campaign. Rick Warren, let's talk about the event that you had recently with Barack Obama and John McCain. First of all, it was a symbol of just how successful what's called the suburban megachurch movement has become. People would be surprised, I guess, to hear that it wasn't an event in Washington National Cathedral, but in the suburbs of LA. Yeah. What is it about that experience that led people like McCain and Obama to your church to have that discussion?
You know, John, for a number of years, I've made as one of my three goals of life to restore civility to civilization. I think our country here in America, I don't know about Australia, but at least in America, we're becoming quite rude with each other. And we don't treat people with respect. In fact, we demonize those we disagree with. And as the world gets smaller and smaller because of globalization, we've got to learn to get along with people we disagree with without turning them into the enemy. You can disagree without being disagreeable. You can walk arm in arm without seeing eye to eye. And so I developed a series at Saddleback Church we called the Saddleback Civil Forums. And what we do in these civil forums is we invite people in from various backgrounds. They don't have to be Christian backgrounds. It could be any kind of background, where we let them share their beliefs and their views, and we listen, and we treat people with respect. I'm trying to get back to the old definition of tolerance. Tolerance used to mean that I will treat you with respect and dignity, even if I have major disagreements with you. I violently disagree with what you believe. I stand as a polar opposite, but you're still a creature made in the image of God, and you deserve dignity and respect. And that's what real tolerance is. But today, tolerance has come to mean all ideas are equally valid. Well, that's nonsense. The person who says the earth revolves around the moon and the one who says the moon revolves around the earth around the sun, they both can't be right. There are some things that are always right and there are some things that are always wrong. But we need to learn to get along. And so we started a series called the Civil Forum, and we've done things like have six Holocaust survivors, Jewish Holocaust survivors, come in and share their stories in our Christian church of what it was like going through Auschwitz. And we sat there as a congregation and wept with them and talked about how our commitment to never allow genocide to happen again. And in August, we had Barack Obama and John McCain, who are both friends of mine. I don't happen to agree with either of them completely, but they're both friends. And I invited them to come, and they were on their first forum together. Actually, as I'm talking to you right now, yesterday, I did a third civil forum of this year, which we did on the global health. And I interviewed President George Bush and his wife, Laura, on what they've done in their battle against AIDS through what's called the PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan. Most people don't know that President Bush allocated $15 billion to help people dying of AIDS and malaria and TB around the world. And I invited some friends to share testimonies, share tributes to him. And so yesterday we had President Clinton, President-elect Obama. We had President Bush. We had Bill Gates. I invited Tony Blair to speak, Bono, Bill and Melinda Gates, President Kagame of Rwanda, and a number of different world leaders to talk about this issue of global health. And so we just are trying to provide a civil forum where people can discuss things and disagree without demonizing each other.
You're saying something that to many people will be uncontentious, yet in the context of the way politics and religion have squared off in the United States over the last 15 to 20 years, yeah, you may be seen to be saying something quite radical, that God isn't the exclusive preserve of the Republican Party.
Yeah, well, he's not, obviously. And what we believe in is I believe in what we Americans call the separation of church and state. I do not believe in the separation of religion and politics. And here's the reason why. Religion or faith is simply a worldview. And everybody has a worldview. Buddhism is a worldview. Christianity is a worldview. Judaism is a worldview. Secularism is a worldview. Atheism is a worldview. Communism is a worldview. Everybody has some kind of worldview. And for a person to say, well, you can talk about politics, but you can't bring your worldview with you. Well, that's impossible, because every time you make a decision, you base it on your worldview. Christianity is just one of the worldviews of the world. And so we think it's entirely appropriate that everybody have a place at the table. And so, as I said, I'm against government sponsoring religion or religion trying to control government. I'm against that. But I am in favor of everybody being welcome to the table, whether they're secularist or atheist or Christians or Muslims or whatever.
But there is a particular worldview that has been associated with American evangelicalism over the last 20 years that is somewhat different from the evangelical worldview of, say, 100 years ago. 100 years ago, 120 years ago, in the fight against slavery, the fight for women's rights, the evangelical churches were seen, if you like, to use the loose caricature, rather more on the left in society. These days, in the last 30 years, they've been identified with being more on the right in society.
You're making a great point, John, and there's a history behind this, and that is about 100 years ago, evangelicals were actually the social activists of society here in America. It was the evangelicals who brought about women's rights, the right to vote. It was evangelicals who fought against slavery and the abolition of slavery. It was evangelicals who worked for child labor laws. It was evangelicals who worked for the environment and the breakup of large monopolies, and they've always been socially active. But what happened is about 100 years ago, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were a number of theologians who came out with what was called the, quote, social gospel. And this phrase basically meant we don't really need Jesus or the cross or the Bible or personal salvation anymore. All we need to do is redeem the social structures of society and the world will automatically get better. And basically, it was simply Marxism in Christian form. And they were saying we don't need the personal salvation and redemption and repentance. We just need to make the world a better place through social action. At that point, Protestantism, Catholics never split over this, but the Protestants in America split into two groups. And the mainline Protestants of Methodist and Presbyterian and Episcopalian, they said, we're going to take the body, and the evangelical and or the fundamentalist, both of those different groups, and there is a difference between an evangelical and a fundamentalist, they said, we're going to take the soul. And so the mainline group said, we're going to work on social justice. We're going to work on racism, economic issues, poverty, disease, and things like that, social issues. And the evangelical said, we're going to work on personal issues like family issues and personal salvation and personal morality. Well, which of them was right? Well, in my opinion, they were both right. And part of my goal and job and role as a leader in the 21st century is I'm trying to bring those back together, and I'm saying they both matter, body and soul, social and personal. They both matter.
That Christianity, as much as about personal transformation, is about social transformation.
It's both.
You're on ABC Radio Around Australia. Rick Warren is our guest of Saddleback Church in the United States, author of The Purpose-Driven Life and, more recently, The Purpose of Christmas. Rick Warren, let's talk a little bit now about the sorts of things that Saddleback has been criticised for over the years.
Sure.
Saddleback has been criticised for delivering religion light, that is, religion without the cost of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Garrison Keillor speaking a few weeks ago, and he said that the small church that he grew up in, he said, was shaped by words. We loved the King James Version of the Bible, and we loved the rich poetry that our hymn books brought to us. We weren't a 7-11 church. And he said, by that I mean you take the same seven words and sing them 11 times. and you know what he was getting at.
Well, it's interesting. For instance, he must not like the Handel's Messiah, because the word hallelujah is used, I think, 49 times in a row. So that would be called classic literature and classic music. And it was interesting that when Handel wrote Messiah, it was roundly derided as vulgar theater because it repeated too much. So to me, that is a really dumb statement to make. In the first place, people who criticize Saddleback have never been here. They don't know what we do. In fact, most people could not join Saddleback Church because they wouldn't be willing to meet the commitments. Most people don't know that our church is built on a series of four what we call covenants. There's a membership covenant. There is a spiritual maturity covenant. There's a covenant to be involved in ministry. And there's a covenant to serve in ministry around the world, helping the poor and the sick. And we sign these covenants, and we go through classes. And most people in the world could not join Saddleback because they would not be willing to step up to the covenants and the commitments we request. I would take any 500 members of our church and match them to 500 members of any other church in the world in terms of spiritual knowledge, knowledge of the Bible versus memorized, number of people serving in a ministry and serving. Do you know, John, in the last 4 years, I've had 7,756 of my members go overseas, pay their own way, and volunteer to serve in helping the poor, serving the poor, ministering to the sick in what we call our peace plan in 68 countries.
But what do you think generally about this whole critique that is offered of suburban megachurch style, that what you do is you deliver religion light, if you like, and that has been a general critique that you've had to deal with over the years?
It's a bogus critique. I think it's a bogus critique by jealous people. I think that the bottom line is that envy and jealousy among pastors is quite large, and just as doctors resent other doctors who are successful, if a church is successful, then people are going to want to go to it. If a church has such quality, it automatically attracts people. If your church genuinely loves people, you'd have to lock the doors to keep people out. And if people aren't coming to their church, it's saying something real clear. You don't love people. Don't love them. Because if you love them, people flock to where they are loved.
The connection with love has to be a human connection. And one of the things that people have looked to in the success side of the Saddleback Ledger is the way in which you've wedded, in some ways, two models. You've wedded the mass celebration of the mega church together with the house group model of the cell group that you stitch together by networks.
You're exactly right, John. In fact, I'm so happy that you brought this up, because this is the secret. Most people, when they talk about the, quote, mega church, and that's a title I don't really like. I don't even use it myself. But what they look at is they think that the church is what happens on Sunday morning when you have the large crowds of 1,000 people or 2,000 people or even more than that show up, and there's great music and great preaching and there are great programs for the children and all of that. But what happens on Sunday morning in the typical large church is really the tip of the iceberg. It's like the 5% above ground that everybody sees and all the media and all of the journalists write about. But the real church is what happens during the week below the ground. For instance, at Saddleback Church, you can come on Sunday morning and see a large crowd of people worshiping, singing, praising God, hearing messages, taking their children to different children's programs. What they don't see is during the week we have over 4,000 small groups that meet in homes all across Southern California. We're actually in 136 cities of Southern California. Every city in the Los Angeles area has Saddleback small groups in it. We have over 30,000 people attending Bible study in small groups every single week. More people go to Bible study in a small group at Saddleback than are actually able to come on Sunday morning. We couldn't even fit them all on Sunday morning. So the heartbeat of the church is the small groups. And out of those small groups, we do all kinds of different ministries. And in our church, we have over 400 different ministries to the community, ministries to people in prison, to those who are dealing with drug addictions, to those who are homeless, to stressed out CEOs, to mothers who are trying to raise their kids as single parents. Literally over 400 different kinds of ministries, reading ministries, language ministries, job skills ministries, and on that reach out. And that's where the real church is. If I were to drop dead today, right this moment, Saddleback Church would keep going because, first place, I'm not the only pastor. There are 14 other pastors who actually help share teaching. There are over 9,000 people that we have commissioned as lay ministers in our church. And those 9,000 lay ministers would keep the church running. They're not shallow. They're not weak. They're giving more commitment than the average person in the average small church.
In some ways, what you're talking about, and I've read this, so it's not my idea exclusively. I think somebody in the writing in the New Yorker suggested that what you're actually doing is, in some ways, you're taking the military model. You're down there working with platoons of people.
Yeah. Platoons. Yeah, that would be one idea. The other idea is that of a if you've got an ocean liner, the ocean liner also has 100 little lifeboats on it, and we consider the small groups or the lifeboats. You don't have to know everybody in a church to feel like it's your church, but you do have to know somebody. And so we make sure that everybody is connected into a small group of 4, 6, 8 people where they're loved, they're cared for. If they get sick and in the hospital, they're visited when their meals need to be brought to them. One of the reasons that churches grow bigger and bigger is they figured out how to minister to people's personal needs, which many churches haven't figured that out, and so they stay small because they depend on all the needs to be met by one person. They expect the pastor to be the super pastor. He's supposed to do all the hospital visiting, all the praying, all the teaching, all the baptizing, all the caring for people. And Saddleback Church outgrew me about 28 years ago. The average pastor can handle about maybe 75 to 100 people. And for a church to grow beyond that, the pastor must be willing to give up the ministry and let other people do it, and the people must be able to give up the leadership and let the pastor build a staff that can minister to individual needs. The key is ministering to individual needs. If you do that, then the church keeps growing.
It used to be called the priesthood of all believers.
That's exactly what it is. And this these ideas are not new ideas. They're not marketing ideas. They're not business ideas. They're all right there in the Bible. We just want to go back to what the New Testament says. In the New Testament, it says that the believers met daily in the temple courts and from house to house. Now, here's what we call the temple courts, house-to-house ministry, the combination of large group worship and small group fellowship. If you go to the temple courts in Jerusalem, standing, you could hold 50,000 people in a temple courts in Jerusalem. 50,000 people could easily come for service there standing. But where did they put all those people during the week? They spread out into the homes all over the city of Jerusalem, so that by the 25th year after Christ, Jerusalem had a church of about 100,000 people and a city of about 250,000.
You're on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest, Rick Warren, author of The Purpose-Driven Life and more recently The Purpose of Christmas, and the founder of Saddleback Church in the United States. Rick Warren, the church not only grows in numbers, but it grows outside itself in terms of the way it understands its mission. Last year, I think there was a cover of Christianity Today magazine, which used Saddleback as an example of evangelicals rediscovering their role in the world as agents of world change and world development, that it had, if you like, broadly, to go back and use your description, a civilizational role.
Mm-hmm.
Your ministry extends out beyond Saddleback. You're now doing work in Africa, but you're also talking in the United States about, as you've indicated, the way civil society needs to behave, that we actually have a role as citizens in the globe.
Be salt and light in the world. You know, John, three things happened in my life about 6 years ago that changed the direction of my life. One of them was my wife got cancer, and while she was, she had breast cancer, and during that time, she read an article that talked about 14 million children orphaned by AIDS, and God spoke to her during that time and said, "You are to become a spokesperson for people who have AIDS." And what we, as she began to study it, we discovered, for instance, more children have AIDS than there are gays in the world. There are more women have AIDS than there are men. And I didn't realize that 40 million people in the world had AIDS, and by the end of 2010, that there will have been over 100 million people have contracted AIDS somewhere around the world. Well, that caught my attention, and I started thinking, what else am I missing that I've been oblivious to? The second thing that happened was the success of the purpose-driven life. That book became the best-selling book, hardback in book in English in history. It sold 30 million copies in America alone. It's in print in over 100 languages. It's the best-selling hardback English book in history, second only to the Bible. Well, that brought in enormous amounts of money and enormous amounts of fame. And it kind of scared me, and I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, literally tens of millions of dollars are coming in, and I'm a pastor. I don't need money. And so I start praying about what do you do with this, Lord? The stewardship of affluence and the stewardship of influence. And I don't have time to go into all of it, but God gave me a passage of Scripture in the New Testament on what to do with the money, and a passage in the Old Testament on what to do with the influence. And maybe I can come out and talk to you about that sometime. But we made five decisions on what to do with the money. If I had wanted to, I could have gone and bought an island and retired and had people serve me iced tea with little umbrellas in it the rest of my life. But that's not the purpose of life. And when you write a book that the first sentence is, it's not about you, then you figure the money is not for you. So we made five decisions. First, I said, we're not going to change our lifestyle one bit. I still live in the same house I've lived in for 16 years. I drive a 9-year-old Ford truck. I wear the same watch I have. It's not a Rolex. I bought it at a Walmart. We live very simple lives. Second, I stopped taking a salary from Saddleback Church. Third, I added up all the church had paid me in 25 years, and I gave it all back because I didn't want anybody thinking that I do what I do because of money, because I don't. I do it because I love Jesus Christ, and if he never did anything else for me, I'm going to give him the rest of my life. And we set up three foundations, one for AIDS and one for leadership training and one for helping the poor. And then my wife and I became reverse tithers. 33 years ago when we got married, we started tithing 10% of our income. And each year we would raise it 11%, 12%, 13%, at least 1% a year. Now, the Bible doesn't say to do that, but we wanted to just be growing in generosity and growing in grace and growing in having a bigger heart. And today, after 33 years of marriage, my wife and I give away 90% and we live on 10%. I've been playing this game for 33 years with God, where God says, you give to me and I'll give to you, and we'll see who wins. And I don't give to get a blessing. I give to be a blessing. And that was the easy part, what to do with the money. Just give it away. So we live on 10% and give away 90% of our income. The other part, though, was what do I do with this influence that I've got? And as I read Psalm 72, which is Solomon's prayer for influence, he says, Lord, I want you to make me famous. I want you to give me power. I want you to give me influence so that the king may support the widow and orphan, defend the defenseless, speak up for the depressed, care for the poor. Talks about all the marginalized of society. And that was a turning point in my life where God said to me, the purpose of influence is to speak up for those who have no influence. And we began to develop what we call the peace plan, which now thousands of churches here in America and in Australia and even around the world are doing. We're now expanding it into over 400,000 churches in 162 countries. And the peace plan is simply a plan of doing the five things that Jesus did, the Prince of Peace. P-E-A-C-E stands for promote reconciliation. E is equip servant leaders. A is assist the poor. C is care for the sick. And E is educate the next generation. And if anybody who's listening would like to know more about how they could be a part of the Peace Coalition, it's businesses, it's churches, it's individuals, literally all around the world trying to make a difference. They can write to me at Pastor Rick, that's one word, Pastor Rick at saddleback.com, one word, saddleback.com, and ask about the peace plan. We'll be glad to send them information.
Rick Warren, it's been great to have you on ABC Radio. Thanks very much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
You stood before creation, eternity, yeah.
Sort of music you'd hear at Rick Warren's church any Sunday of the year. Contemporary American gospel, attuned very much to feel-good pop. But the American gospel tradition is much richer than that. And for the next few moments, let's hear a little of the traditions that are informing Barack Obama. Here's Johnny Cash from his mother's hymn book. The CD, My Mother's Hymn Book. I shall not be moved.
Glory, hallelujah, I shall not be moved. Anchored in Jehovah, I shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's planted by the waters, I shall not be moved. In his love abiding, I shall not be moved. And in him confiding, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved. I shall not be, I shall not be moved. I shall not be, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the waters, I shall not be moved. Though all hell assail me, I shall not be moved. Jesus will not fail me, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved. Though the tempest rages, I shall not be moved. On the rock of ages, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved. I shall not be, I shall not be moved. I shall not be, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved. I shall not be, I shall not be moved. I shall not be, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved.
Johnny Cash from My Mother's Hymn Book. A little of the folk tradition informing American gospel music. So much of that will be reflected at the Lincoln Memorial in a few hours' time when Bishop Gene Robinson commences the week of inauguration celebrations for Barack Obama with a prayer of invocation at the place where Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech some 40 years ago. Let's reach further back into that tradition now. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, who we began this hour with the Shaker song, Simple Gifts.
'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to calm down where you want to be, and when you find yourselves in the place just right, 'twill be.